Welcome to a special edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We're coming on the air a little bit earlier than usual today because, as most of the state knows by now, this morning, Georgia lost one of its great giants of politics, Zell Miller.
Listen to this voice. It's a voice flavored by the Blue Ridge. A voice straight out of a remote valley hidden among the peaks and hollows of the Appalachian Mountains. A voice that's been described as more barbed wire than honeysuckle. That this kind of voice could travel here from a forgotten corner of Appalachia is a testament to the grace of God and the greatness of the Democratic Party.
That was Zell Miller giving the keynote speech at the 1992 Democratic Convention in New York City. One of the highlights of his political career on the national stage. Of course, he served as the longest-serving lieutenant governor the state had ever had. He served two terms as governor, went on to serve in the United States Senate, and we're going to talk about his life and career for the first part of our show today. Joining me, of course, in the studio, as he does every Monday and Friday, is my partner, Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And we have two of the most important mayors in the state with us today, Columbus Mayor Teresa Tomlinson and Sandy Springs Mayor Rusty Paul. Thank you all so much for being here today. It's Jim, it's not unexpected because he has been sick for a long time, but I think we all feel, those of us who've spent so many years watching his career and covering his career, felt the loss.
Right, right. The family gave us notice in October that this was imminent, that he would be making no more public appearances. And really, he had been off the stage for 2004 was when he left the Senate. But nonetheless, this is the man who dominated state capital politics and Washington politics for 25 years and more.
Yeah.
I've written more words about Zell Miller than any single individual in the state.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing as people in our newsroom looked through archives, video archives. I was thinking about how many times I interviewed him when I was over at Channel 2 News in Atlanta. And he was a dominant force in my life as a political journalist. I want to get to Teresa and Rusty and bring them in on the conversation. But right now, we have on the phone first, and everybody can weigh in with us on this, Keith Mason. Keith, you're very generous to spend a little time with us today. One of Zell Miller's most important political advisors, and I think fair to say, Keith, one of his closest friends. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Bill. It's great to be with you and Jim and Mayor Tomlinson and Mayor Paul. I'm a constituent of Mayor Paul and a fan of Mayor Tomlinson, so I feel like I'm kind of, hitting a doubleheader here with the two of them on the show, so I don't want to take away from their limelight, but you're kind to include me in this discussion about this good friend of mine.
Keith, we're going to obviously talk about his impact politically, but before we do, can you give us a little picture, paint a picture of how things went this morning up there in Young Harris?
I really cannot speak to that. That would be something best left to members of the family who were there, so I want to respect that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I tell you what, Keith, if you could, before we went on air, you and I were speaking just about, you heard the clip from 1992, the Democratic Convention, and which was, that's got to rank as one of the best convention speeches of all time. That was followed quite a few years later in 2004 by Zell's appearance at the Republican National Convention when he endorsed George W. Bush.
He's the only person who has given the keynote speech at both a Democratic and a Republican National Convention.
Right, but it precipitated a terrific rift between Zell and many of his Democratic friends. And you and I were talking about how in his last years he tried to rebuild those bridges. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think as time went on beyond that period in the mid-2000s, he very much wanted to rebuild any bridges that might have been broken or severely impacted as a result of some of the things that occurred when he was a member of the Senate. I personally was one who was not very fond of some of the positions and actions that he did while there, but I never forgot all he did for me or lost my gratitude for what he did for me or what he's meant to me and so many others over the course of his career at that time. And it's over time, it just got more special.
And you did help him reach out, did you not?
Yes. I helped him with some people, took James Carville up there for a visit, and they had begun to heal over the years, and we got together, and then he later took him to do the Young Harris commencement in 2015, and I recall that that morning, and Zell has had significant health problems for a number of years, and there have been periods over the last 5 or 6 where we thought he would not be with us much longer, but fortunately he was up until this day, and I mentioned to James, I said, not to get you dark before the speech, but this will probably be the last time that all three of us are together. It certainly was in Young Harris, but we were able to also have another visit with him in the hospital, he, Steve Wrigley, and I, and Shirley.
Keith, I want to start with you, and then I really want to hear what Mayor Paul and Mayor Tomlinson, how they would answer this question. When you think of Governor Miller, Senator Miller, what's the greatest thing what is his true legacy to this state?
Well, I think by most people's standards, it would be his contribution to education and his political courage and commitment to pass what was a controversial thing, passage of statewide gambling, the form of a Georgia lottery that funded a voluntary pre-kindergarten program and the infamous Hope Scholarship Program that has opened the doors wide open for access to higher education for working Georgian families.
Hope Scholarship, everybody thinks about and talks about Teresa and Rusty, and certainly it's a great program for many families, not without its issues, but it's been important to them. What sometimes people don't talk about is free pre-kindergarten, which was also part of that whole lottery measure. And I listened back to some speeches of Zell's this morning and heard him emphasizing that. Sure, he talked about hope, but when you really got him talking, what he talked about was how proud he was of pre-K.
Yeah, he knew that education was his escalator to mobility, as my good friend Calvin Smyre likes to say. And, of course, I'm so glad Keith can be with us here today, someone who spent that time with Zell Miller as he was building such a legacy. And Calvin Smyre was there, too, in his way. And I texted Kathy Cox when I heard the news, and she said, well, a few things. And she said Zell was such a force to be reckoned with in his day.
This is former Secretary of State, Democratic
Kathy
Secretary
Cox.
Of State.
Yes, I'm
Kathy
sorry.
Cox,
yes, I should have specified. And I'm sure, every governor has tremendous power, obviously. But Zell was the king of the Yellow Dog Democrats and the Blue Dog Democrats.
Until he wasn't.
Yeah, and then there was that. But even to this day, there's a lot of Democrats, myself included, that remember that legacy. But you're right. Don't forget remember the CD, him playing the CD
of
the classical music?
It was all Mozart, yes.
Yeah, every new mother got classical music. And so he was very, very committed to education, and he left an incredible mark.
Rusty?
Well, I was on the opposite side of Zell because I was chairman of the state Republican Party at the time, and I used Zell very effectively because I was able to pair him with, even though they didn't really like each other, Speaker Murphy, and talk about to young Democrats that we were trying to get to switch parties at that period when we were reshuffling the deck. And I would say, look, there's no upward mobility. You've got Tom Murphy and Zell Miller have had two of the three top positions in this state for 25 years, and they're not going anywhere. If you want to really move up at the ladder, come with us.
Hey, Keith, it's been a while. So, but you were there. Could you remind us a little bit of how daring it was for a gubernatorial candidate to pitch the idea of gambling in Georgia, of a lottery.
It was a big deal. And I recall Governor Miller weighing it considerably throughout the fall of 1988 after he had already declared to be a candidate for a 1990 race. And Florida had started their lottery. He had seen on the ground evidence of Georgians wanting that opportunity, Georgians going to Florida. And we thought about it long and hard. I'll be brutally honest. I mean, we did our political research, and we saw how it polled in a number of respects. And he saw the advantages to it. And when in January of '89, when we were weighing the decision to come out for the lottery, it was first suggested, well, why don't you come out for the people's right to vote on it, or something? He says, no. If I'm coming out for it, I'm going all the way. I'm not going to be mamby-pamby about this. I'm going to be for the people's right to vote on it and to have it and tie it to education.
Thank you so much. Oh, go ahead, Keith. I'm sorry.
And he did. And I'll never forget this. At that time, Zell, you know, he had been lieutenant governor 16 years and had been defeated for statewide office against Herman Talmadge in 1980 and was, you know, very sensitive to his long tenure in state politics. And he turned to me one day. He says, you know what I like about this lottery? He said, it makes this old face look new. And I reminded him in my last visit with him in October. I said, Governor, I remember you saying that. And it kind of hit home to me here just recently. I said, I am now as old as you were when you were running for governor, and I was helping you run for governor.
Wow. A great story. I thank you for sharing that, because what a testimony to leadership. You know, today people poll, and if it doesn't poll well, then they just leave it on the table. But, you know, here was a leader that said, all right, that's how it polls. Now I'm going to get out there and lead, and let's see how many people we can change.
And he only did it because of what it would do for education. He saw the political mileage of how it could help him get elected, but he also saw the resources that it would bring to the state and make a huge change for education. And he was very meticulous about how that legislation was drafted and implemented from a programmatic standpoint so that it could not be used to supplant existing funds for education.
Rusty, I want to throw this to you, but when Keith says that was the big issue in the 90 run for governor, it really was. We went to his announcement speech at, I think, the Georgia Education Center downtown across from the Capitol.
Yeah.
And that was
the fireplace.
And that was it. That was the speech.
That was it.
Vote for me for governor. I'm going to make a lottery happen so we can have more money for education. So this was not just a big issue. This was the issue in that first race.
It was the defining issue of the campaign. And this was in 1989. He passed it in the Senate with Paul Coverdale's support, I might add, before he became Peace
Republican.
Corps director. And it died in the House, laid over again, but it gave him a two-year issue to run on.
Rusty, how did that affect you as a Republican? You had Johnny Isaacson as your general election candidate, and it was hard to break through.
Well, we were running around calling it reverse Robin Hood, that you were taking from the poor and giving to the rich. But I'll say this about Zell. We crossed swords a few times because of partisanship. But the one thing that strikes me about Zell Miller's legacy is he's one of those few politicians who put the interests of the state, and when he was in the U.S. Senate, the country, ahead of party loyalty. He stayed true pretty much to his principles. And while the parties were going through an enormous tectonic shift during that period, he stayed pretty straight to who he was, a conservative mountain Georgian, and he put the interests of people ahead of party loyalty, and you just don't see that anymore. That was my legacy. My boss, Jack Kemp, used to say, a successful politician puts the interest of the country first ahead of their party, and Zell truly did that.
Yeah, and I'll tell you another thing. Zell was a leader on civil rights issues. And he was the and I remember the debate we had when he was considering it about proposing the change of the Georgia flag.
In, that's right.
In summer of 1992.
Which almost cost him a re-election.
Yep. And it almost cost us the lottery. Mm. We only won that lottery 52-48.
Yes, people don't remember that, Jim Galloway. You know, it's funny, as people up in our newsroom were looking through old clips, and they came across a couple videos of me interviewing Zell during the campaign. One of our younger producers said, "Well, I'm just watching this clip where you're really quizzing him closely on. You seem to be skeptical about whether this lottery will work or not. You're being very hard on him." There were a lot. I said to her, "This was not the popular issue you might think it was."
Oh yeah, I would note that. And tell me if I'm wrong here. Everybody in on the Every voice you're listening to right now is in GPB studios, except for Mr. Mason. And if I'm not mistaken, this entire building
was
built
with lottery funds.
Yes, it was.
And we should say, Keith, I'm glad you brought it up because I was going to. It was criticized. There were Republicans who made comments, criticisms of this facility. But in addition to being a broadcast center, Zell's vision for this place has been completely fulfilled.
Right.
People don't know about the distance learning that we do here, which is very powerful.
And see, when we first started, it was for three things. It was the voluntary pre-kindergarten, the Hope Scholarship, and technology. And the technology term got broadly utilized, okay? And it got taken out over the years. But he very much, you know, continued to refine the lottery program much after I was gone.
This was satellite technology. This was pre-internet.
Right, which is what. Okay, so let's listen to just a little of Zell, and then we'll extend. Keith, can you stay with us for a couple more minutes?
Sure.
Great.
Sure.
All right. Here is Zell Miller. He was it was a C-SPAN conversation, really reflecting on his entire career in politics, He was asked what got him interested in politics in the first place.
My mother served for over 20 years on the Young Harris City Council, and at one time, or twice, was mayor of the little town of Young Harris, Georgia. She was one of the first women mayors in the state of Georgia. And Young Harris is a very, very small little community, about 200 people. And whenever the citizens would pay their taxes, or whenever they would even pay their water bills later when we got a water system, they would come to our house to pay them. And I would listen to these taxpayers say what they thought was wrong with that little town. How they would talk about how their tax money was being spent. My mother was helped hold the elections in that little village. And one of my earliest recollections is sitting over in a corner late at night while they were counting votes. And my mother was the only one in there who was a female.
Zell Miller talking about his early memories of politics. You know, he says, Teresa and Rusty, in that convention speech, you know, this is a voice more barbed wire than honey. And it really is. It's really something. And when Keith Mason starts quoting Zell, he gets that voice, doesn't he, Rusty?
Yeah, that was a pretty good imitation.
I was going to say, I hope that Keith is writing a book of all of Zell's sayings. You know, he was such a fabulous Southern orator, a great storyteller. Is it, Keith, he was the original, if you ever see a turtle on a fence post, you know it didn't get there. Didn't he say that like 1,000 times?
He said that all over the state in this country, yep.
Well, exactly. I hope you'll write them down.
He said that. I mean, when he was out campaigning, you know, he would point that out to people who were considering supporting him, and I will remember you, and all that. And I remember we'd be down in deep South Georgia, and he said he would. This was before cell phones, so he would give out. He said, "Here's my number. I stay at the Red Carpet Inn in downtown Atlanta, and here I'm gonna give it to you right now from a flatbed truck."
He would say, "Whenever I was in Albany, whenever was a big word of
him. Whenever." And he said, "I tell you one thing: if you can't get up with a candidate for somebody who's a candidate for governor, you certainly can't get up with when they become governor."
So, Rusty, I want to. Jim already referred to the 2004 convention speech when he became an advocate of George W. Bush. He couldn't tolerate John Kerry as a Democratic candidate. He would really become very conservative in those days. Do you remember watching that keynote speech at the convention and thinking to yourself, "What is happening?"
Yeah,
here?
It was a bad case of cognitive dissonance for me. But that's what I was referring to. Zell stayed fairly true to his basic principles, and as the party shifted, he stayed pretty straight down. And he did put the interest of the people, the state, the country, ahead of any particular party loyalty, and that's commendable.
So at the end of that speech, that fire and brimstone speech, in which he not only talked up George W. Bush's reelection campaign, but really trashed the Democrats and John Kerry in very harsh terms, he went on MSNBC with Chris Matthews, and they went at it each other. Zell was in a fighting mood.
When was he not in a fighting mood?
Well, that's true. He challenged Matthews, some will recall, to a duel, and it got ugly. And I know Zell eventually was really embarrassed by that moment. Brian, his grandson, has said that. But Chris was on our show not long ago. Jim, you were with us the day that Chris was on. And we asked him about that, and we said, "Is it true that you actually wrote a letter to Zell because you wanted to make peace with him?" And here's what Chris said.
"The guy had a heroic career. He's a great public servant. And I did get the sense, I didn't write this in the note, that he was high-hatted by some of the northern liberals. I think they looked down on him, and I think he felt that. And I think that there's always a personal story behind these things, the breaking with the Democrats. I don't think he was treated well when he got to the Senate. And I felt bad because I knew he was a better man than that incident. And by the way, I got to tell you something that's so funny. Now, after that incident, I told all my producers, be careful and stop talking about this right now, because I thought he meant it. I said, I'm going to end up on the bluffs of the Hudson River with a couple of Confederate dueling pistols, and how I do not want to be there. I don't know how it would happen, but I thought it was really happening, and I said, cool it, guys.
Galloway, can you say Hamilton?
I was, this must have been, I guess, probably 2003. I'd made a trip up to D.C. and stopped by to see him, to see Zell and Joan Kirchner, who had become his chief of staff.
Yeah.
And who is
now
Johnny Isaacson's chief of staff. And he was a frustrated man.
Yeah.
He always preferred to be called Governor Miller, mm-hmm. never Senator mm-hmm. Miller in his retirement. And every day he would tear off the page of the calendar on his desk and just kind of fold it up and say, "Another day shot
to hell."
Well,
you know what? Here's an important thing to point out. There are two people sitting in this studio, two mayors of major Georgia cities, who would probably really relate to this. You're the CEOs of your city in the same way that Zell Miller was the CEO of Georgia for 8 years, and going to the United States Senate and being one of 100 bozos who can't get anything done. Of course, he was frustrated.
My family tried to get me to run for Tom Price's congressional seat, and I said, "Guys, you guys are nuts. Go from being the mayor of the sixth largest city in the state to being one of 435. I go home every day happy." So
I'm sure, and you know, he mentioned in one of his books that it was really post 9/11 that affected him so much. And so I don't know what that played to that particular exchange. But I do want to give a shout out to Bertie Miller for being his mother, one of the first women mayors. Thank you so much for cutting the path for the rest of us.
Keith, she must have been a remarkable woman. She here she is in that little mountain town way up in North Georgia. She's involved in civics and politics, but she also is a student at the Arts Student League of New York. She was an artist. So Zell was an author. Zell wrote country music songs. So in many ways, he got from her the love of the arts and music, culture, and the political side. Really interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she brought that side out to him, and she gave him inspiration that you could get anywhere in the world from young Harris. And that's how he looked at it, and that's why he was, you know, so committed to education being the only road out. And that's why he did that. I mean, he would quote her on the campaign trail, and he would, you know, he had something like, he says, my mother, you know, and he would describe a lot of things you just said. He said, she had this saying that it was called, take what you want, saith the Lord, take it and pay for it. And I used to think that that was out of the Bible, but I later learned that was part in Bertie's scripture. And he said, and that's what he would talk about. And that's where his fiscal responsibility came into full focus, was watching his mother doing what she needed to do in the household, but also on behalf of the taxpayers of that small town.
Keith, we would also be remiss if we did not remember Shirley Miller at this, point.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is the woman who kind of took care of the business end of Miller Incorporated.
And she did it all.
And she was also that diplomat. She was the person who smoothed out the rough edges that Zell left behind often.
All right, we are going to we're at a point where we've really got to take a break. We know that in the days ahead there will be tributes to Zell Miller. There will be several. You've learned there are at least there are a couple of memorials, probably three of them, and there will be details about those coming up. So we'll have plenty of time on this show next week to recount some more stories about Zell Miller. But in the meantime today, Keith Mason, thank you so much. And you were so close to him that we send you to you our condolences as well. We've all lost a man who we at times were frustrated with, questioned closely about some of the things he wanted to do. But in the long run, I think there was a lot of love for Zell
Absolutely.
Miller.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Keith, let me leave you with this, and Bill, since you were Zell Miller's partner in this, when I texted, somebody texted me to tell me of Zell's passing, and I texted my policy director, and I said, please confirm this is true before I say anything, and he said, it is true, and then he said, he's the reason I was able to go to college. Now, here was a young man that was brought up, his father died, too, when he was an infant. He was the reason I was able to go to college.
We are Twitter. We're getting some tweets at PoliticsGPB. J.P. Cunningham just said the same thing. He said, Zell Miller made it possible for me to graduate with zero debt. That's an incredible legacy. So, all right, let's do this. Keith, thank you very much being with us. Let's get a break out of the way. And we do have, we're down to the last 2 days of the legislature next week. And there's a lot of issues that we're going to want to talk about there with our special guests, Mayor Rusty Paul of Sandy Springs and Mayor Teresa Tomlinson of Columbus. What an easy show for us, Galloway. We got so many good talkers. We can just sit back and watch.
Yeah, I'm done.
We'll be right back. Back with Mayors Rusty Paul and Teresa Tomlinson, a Democrat, Teresa Tomlinson, a Republican, Rusty Paul. We keep this show balanced. And, of course, Jim Galloway, who you read on Wednesdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the newspaper, and who oversees the Political Insider blog at Politically Georgia at myajc.com. You can watch us on Facebook Live if you go to gpbnews.com. .com/PR. No, I'm sorry. Just go to GPB, go to Facebook and go to GPB
Google
News.
Politically Georgia.
And we're there. And also tweet us at Politics GPB. Tom Faust points out to me that it was that J.P. Cunningham retweeted a tweet that came from Bailey. It was Bailey Shea, the young woman who said it was because of Zell Miller she was able to graduate from college debt-free. I just thought we should point that out. Sam Burnham tweets, "We appreciated that Zell stood up for us in the real Georgia, challenging Matthews and correcting the New York Times on pot liquor, P-O-T-L-I-K-K-E-R, not pot liquor." He always defended us in our way of life. You know, that one last thing, and you may know. Oh,
Snuffy Smith.
Yes. And when somebody used the word hillbilly, oh, Zell became furious. He thought of that as about as derogatory a description as all those other obscene descriptions of other people.
He conducted a campaign with the AJC, and I think he won it, to have Snuffy Smith, the comic, removed from the newspaper.
That's exactly right. All right. So let's move on. And if we can, Rusty, I want to start with an issue we have not talked about a single time. But in the last 2 days of the legislature, we want to, you know, clean up what's going on down there. And here's an issue that when I first saw kind of the initial reporting on it, I thought, well, this isn't very interesting. But it really is. Tell me what this bill that appears on its way to the governor's desk for signature about not allowing you, because this relates to Sandy Springs directly, you are going to lose the right to prohibit wood construction in buildings in Sandy Springs, as our other municipalities around the state. What is this all about?
Well, we passed an ordinance in 2016 that limited the height that you could put wood construction. It started, truthfully, as a growth management tool, but when we passed it,
against apartment complexes?
Basically, because we were getting inundated with them. And then after we passed it, the police chief came to me that night and said, I want to thank you for doing that. And I said, well, chief, why does this bother you? He said, then he started telling me stories about these apartment complexes where he is scared to death to send his firefighters into the buildings when they're burning because they go up so fast. They double in size every 5 minutes. And I've watched one of them burn. I've also watched the videotape of a woman trapped in a second-story apartment who had to jump out, and she broke her back and is paralyzed for life because the flames were moving so fast she had no other option. So when we really started digging into it, it became an issue. And it became an issue in rural Georgia this year because, as we know, this is the theme this year is rural redevelopment, bringing people back to Georgia, to the rural part of the state. And I'm a farm kid. I was a tree farmer. My family planted 3,000 trees a year. But it really got caught up in the real concerns that rural Georgia has, that any attack on their economy could be fatal. And there's this divide that occurs, and it's not only on this bill. Mayor Thomas and I were talking about this earlier. There's probably more bills that take away local control from in decision making, more bills than I've ever seen in a General Assembly. There's the small cell bill. There's this bill. There's all kinds of other legislation. There was a bill to limit us from regulating and controlling puppy mills and
no
bed
smoking
and breakfast
areas.
And it's just a total assault on local government, which is concerning to me as a Republican. and concerning is a very strong understatement. I get it. I get why the panic in rural Georgia. I really do understand that. But there's not a willingness to allow different parts of the state to deal with different political problems and situations. And that's the political problem that causes me the greatest concern.
Teresa?
Yeah, it really
these
is.
These guys down at the Gold Dome are behaving like liberal Democrats in New York State.
Well, we complained about
California.
This last time we were all together, and I was complaining about the right-of-way bill where, because they're trying to help, the state legislature is trying to help expand broadband throughout rural Georgia, they've now ceded the city, the municipal right-of-way to these carriers, AT&T, WOW, you know, all these, so they can put poles up wherever they want without any thought, by the way, of sight distance when you're trying to pull out on a busy road, things we have to worry about in more urbanized areas, without any thought as to whether we're about to do a $55 million road expansion in that area and now are going to have to wait 6 months for them to move their antennas. I mean, all of these things. And so I never again want to hear a conservative, a Republican, say to me that local government is a laboratory of democracy, because I've never heard so much hooey and hypocrisy is going on up there now.
And there's a real cultural divide, truly. I mean, you know, when you're going down through a rural area, and I grew up on a farm, I grew up in rural Alabama, and you put a pole up, you put up a electronic box, it's no big deal. In areas where Teresa and I have, you're putting those things in people's front yards. Yep. The rights of way go through their yards. Mm-hmm. And when Comcast and AT&T were putting fiber in, they would just dig up a small patch of grass. You would have thought that Sherman was back in town. it's those kinds of lack of understanding and an unwillingness to understand that causes me real concern.
And it's in many cases, it's almost only symbolic, because this bill that we were talking about, the start
wood
of this conversation,
the wood
construction bill, that's intended to protect the forestry industry, of course,
in Georgia.
In Georgia,
right?
But as Rusty was saying off air,
where are you getting your wood from?
95% of the wood used in construction in Sandy Springs comes from Idaho, Oregon, and Canada. We're protecting the Canadian wood. Our wood goes to pulp. You know, it doesn't. It's not used. We never let it get big enough to be timber.
There has got to be a way to craft this legislation with legitimate policy concerns about expanding broadband and not impede upon the local governments. I know we have legislative council that's capable of doing that. I know it's possible. And they're painting with such a broad brush, Bill, that this is really going to affect local governments, tie our hands in ways that are going to make the everyday running of government virtually impossible.
And it's going
to
send their constituents in areas like Teresa and mine and a lot of these urban areas, it's going to send them into outer space.
So, mm-hmm. Jim, here's a, from a political point of view, what is interesting about this, among other things, is, Republicans have run, and voters seem to respond positively to talk about big government. Democrats are big government. They always want to interfere with your personal rights, that sort of thing. Yet these things are not going to register unless Democrats find some way to convince voters that these are, in many ways, big government intruding.
Well, this is why we have a race for governor and for lieutenant governor, and maybe some future races where somebody is going to run for something. But we are entering a period where big government is the stuff that the other guy controls.
Yeah, I would say you could do it with maybe a broader theme of good government, Bill, but you're right. Sometimes people don't want to hear about these individual things, and that's certainly not something they're running to the ballot box necessarily, but it is a culmination of a lot of frustration of not being able to maximize the day-to-day lives and workings of our citizens because our hands being tied by people from far away. But let me just say this. You know, I've been involved in politics and government for really all my adult life or more, and people have always said, no man's property is safe when the legislature is in session, right? And that just used to incense me because of my idealism that government was there to promote the general welfare of the people. And now, as mayor, I literally am like, oh my God, how many more days are those people going to be convened up there?
And I agree with you. But I'm from Washington and I'm here to help you.
You're right, right.
Now I'm from Atlanta and I'm here to help you. I'm
But I will tell you, Bill, I rue the day. I desperately don't want it to come, but I foresee a day when we're going to be looking at this wood construction bill. And we're going to be facing a terrible tragedy. The state code allows structures up to 5 stories of plywood and pine 2x4s.
Yes,
we're going to have a situation where we're going to say, "How did we get here?" And this is where it began.
Well, and my fire chief pointed out something that was very key to this. it's not just the wood. Now they put it's all the glue and all the adherence that they use. They don't use nails anymore.
It's
they
glue them all together.
Yeah,
materials.
And they go up so much faster, so much hotter. So that's the real problem. I mean, there's a true public safety issue here that just seemed to get ignored. I was sitting in the back as my fire chief was testifying, and every one of the senators said, "We appreciate what you do." And I'm sitting back there thinking, words are nice, but actions are better.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to another issue that is remains unresolved at this point, and it has gotten an awful lot of attention, Jim, and that's the hidden predator bill. Mm-hmm. The bill, quite simply, would expand the relief available to a victim of childhood sexual abuse by extending the age at which that person can make a complaint to from 20-something to 32 or something like that. Plus, it would hold the organizations responsible if it can be proven that the organization knew something was going on and didn't act on it.
And I think that was the big sticking point.
Sure.
This bill was supposed to be heard in Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday night, which produced a Republican confab off campus. They couldn't come to an agreement, so they simply just walked away from it. That evening on Thursday, they passed a watered down version of the bill, which the bill's sponsor, Jason Spencer of Woodbine, says he's going to ask his House colleagues to reject it.
He said he was quoted as saying, "I'm going to have to go back to Woodbine and tell the five people who say that they were victims are not going to get the relief that I had promised I was going to try to bring to them." So, Rusty, I'm curious about this. So, one of the organizations, this has been lobbied heavily against by the Catholic Church. You would look. I mean, I understand as an organization may question how you prove that they were culpable in some way. On the other hand, the Catholic Church does not need any more negative publicity in terms of how it deals with childhood predators.
No, you've got the Catholic Church, you've got the Boy Scouts. There are a number of groups down there who see the potential of this bill being a source of financial ruin. It's a very difficult subject to deal with. I mean, I've got five kids. We had a predator in my community when I was a kid, and I was just very fortunate because my parents he was a barber and drop me off in the chair and leave me, you know?
Yeah.
We never did anything to me that I'm aware of, but, you know, it's tough because you're dealing with kids and kids are afraid to say anything. And it's only when you become an adult. I think we have to figure out how to make this work. And yes, there are institutions, important institutions, good institutions that may be threatened, but you've got to be able to lance this boil in some way or the other.
Yeah, it is. It's a very tough situation. You know, as a lawyer, you have these statute of limitations because you want people to be able to defend themselves. If you wait for so long, the evidence is gone, people have died, but yet the organization is still responsible or is at least being alleged to be responsible. And so you understand that. You want the laws to be obviously just, and yet you're dealing with one of the most horrific crimes that can ever be committed to individuals that largely, as Rusty was saying, that they don't know really what's happening, don't fully appreciate it. And then, of course, they sort of want to forget about it. And so, but I will say this, the one thing that the statute of limitations are supposed to do is encourage people to come forward as soon as possible. If people know they have until they're 38 instead of 23, they may delay. And of course, all the time that predator is still out there.
Okay. We'll watch. It looks like this bill is going to be the watered down version, unless the House takes Jason Spencer up on his request that they vote this thing down completely.
Right, which means we'll be here again this next year.
Right. You know, Jim, it's interesting. Another issue that we're waiting for a resolution on, but that Governor Deal's now weighed in on. We just got done talking about big government interfering with municipalities and how they run things. The hands-free bill, the distracted driving bill, just got Governor Deal's support. But, of course, one of the issues that's weighing this down a bit is this the government intruding on your right to hold a cell phone when you're driving down the street?
Right. The personal sovereignty issue has been raised in the gubernatorial election on the Republican side. Governor Deal, in a GPB lawmakers interview on Wednesday, endorsed this bill that's authored by John Carson out of Cobb County. And because it had been mired again in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and actually the governor's endorsement has ended up pushing that along. The Judiciary Committee has reported the bill out, and Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, who had at a forum in Columbus, as a matter of fact, had said that this bill would have a hard time passing its chamber, now has endorsed it.
Yeah, to me, this is, and I'm sorry, but it's just silly. We've been down this road before with seatbelts and helmets and airbags and all sorts of things. And the bottom line is, unquestionably, our lawmakers have the authority to promote our general welfare, and my personal liberty stops where it starts to harm you.
Is this a personal liberty issue for you,
no,
Rusty?
No, it's not. I can tell you what we have seen in Sandy Springs. We have 285 and 400 are the major thoroughfares through town. We had really depressed the number of roadway fatalities, and they're rising again. And in fact, the chief of police reported to us about a month ago that now distracted driving far exceeds drunk driving and any other single cause of fatal accidents in our community. People's lives are, and again, people are dying because their screens on your dashboard, your phone's in your hand, you're so many things going on that you've got to stay focused on the road, and we've got to do something to, all the technology is great, but it's got to be used properly.
Well, the first time in 20 years, vehicle automotive deaths are going up. We obviously have to respond to that.
All right, let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way. And when we come back, Teresa Tomlinson, you can start the conversation off because we're going to talk about where you're headed for your weekend.
That's right.
That's our tease. We'll be back after this. We're back. Ted Barfield tweets, right or wrong, financial liability for past incidents, speaking of sexual abuse, would be an existential threat for the Boy Scouts who are fighting this and other organizations. Monday's Child says, I'm fit to be tied over the legislature interfering with local jurisdictions. I saw that correlation between complaints of federal government overreach and our state GOP doing the same thing. Sheesh, we will find ways to point this out to the voters. Teresa Tomlinson, you're headed out of town. Where are you going?
Yes, the March for Our Lives in D.C. I have to give my husband credit for this. I would have been in the March for Our Lives in Columbus or certainly Atlanta, both of which are having large marches. But my husband saw this when it was happening, down at Douglas in Florida, and he said, I want to go support those kids. And at that time, we didn't know there were going to be these other marches. And he made all the arrangements. And so we're going. I'm actually going to be on a panel with two other mayors from Baltimore and D.C. talking about gun violence in cities. And let me just share this with you, Bill. What we're talking about here, I've never heard, I'm just going to be honest, I've never heard a single person in my entire life say we're going to get rid of hunting or we're going to get rid of somebody's right to own a firearm to protect their home and their family. But just a month ago, somebody walked in with an AR-15. To our public safety building, where our police department is held, and stood silently in the lobby with citizens passing back and forth. And there is a Georgia law that says no police officer can approach him, no police officer can ask him for his permit or ask him what his intentions are until such time as he begins firing. So let's just say, once he begins firing, we're not going to be asking to see his permit. Fortunately, nothing happened. But that is a reckless and crazy gun law. And there's plenty of others that we could talk about. We're forced to give guns back after we've confiscated them from murderers, rapists, and robbers. We have to sell them back to dealers so they can put them back on the streets. It's just crazy gun laws we need to be done with.
Rusty, what do your police tell you about all of this?
Well, Sandy Springs had, when we started our city, before we started the city, had 13 homicides. Last year, we had zero. So gun violence is, but even so, I can tell you in suburban areas, mothers, parents, when they send their kids to school, they're worried. They're worried, are they going to come home at the end of the day? And, you know, we just need to use some common sense. I mean, my dad gave me my first gun when I was 12 years old. It didn't work very well, but I had one. bad misfire. But, you know, I've grown up around firearms, and I've taken my wife and my daughters through the police training systems that we have. My wife's got a skill now that I wish she didn't have. She's putting them in a pattern about the size of this red Solo cup, but we do need to use some common sense and making sure that background checks, screening, all those sorts of things. I don't see where that jeopardizes your rights. I think those are just common sense kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, look, I meet very few people who say that bump stocks and high capacity don't cross some sort of line. Yeah. And that's you know, if you're sending off your kid off to school, that's what worries you.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
I mean, we have enough with the single shot violence. Mm-hmm. It's the high capacity stuff. And we Bill, we need to mention that there's going to be a similar rally at the state capitol here.
They're
in
going
Atlanta.
To start at the yep. Center for Civil and Human Rights and march to the Capitol. So you're right. This could be a very big march tomorrow here.
Right. Yeah. Not unlike the Women's March of last year.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I think the first thing to think about is Rusty was saying with common sense is if your law enforcement agencies are screaming and begging you not to pass that law, you should pause. Like they opposed guns everywhere. Bill, they opposed campus carry and they opposed the requirement to put guns back on the street. And that should have been our first sign as a people that maybe this is a step too far.
And yet, we don't have any reason to think there's going to be any action of a significant nature. Not much of anything is going to happen in either the state legislature or in Congress.
No. I think legislative measures are off the table. I think we now have to look at electoral measures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is going to be something seismic, much like the Harvey Weinstein. There's just going to be this moment and a tipping point, and we're going to wonder why it took us so long. And so that's where I think we're going.
Well, let's look at one more legislative issue that's gotten a lot of attention. And let me start it by saying that, interestingly enough, Butch Conway, the sheriff up in Gwinnett County, who has been around for a long, long time, was in Washington at a session with President Trump about the issue of whether or not local law enforcement has to, in fact, work with ICE to identify when they make an arrest, if they have ascertained that the person is an undocumented resident, turn them over to ICE. Gwinnett does it, Cobb does it, but most other jurisdictions in the state right now don't do it.
Right, especially if those jurisdictions are down in South Georgia where you've got a lot of crops to pick.
Right. All right. So the question becomes, where do we stand? Jim, maybe I should start with you and then get Rusty and Teresa in here. Where do we stand on this measure that the legislature has been looking at, which would once again tell the cities how to do their business in this regard?
Right. I think this is SB 452.
Yeah.
It's been endorsed by Casey Cagle. It required local law enforcement officials to hand over any undocumented people that fall into their hands through investigations or traffic stops, et cetera, that has been somewhat softened a little bit. Now the legislation, I think, says that they may, law enforcement officers may do that. It's not a requirement.
Yeah.
Well, in our city, our police department doesn't see itself as ICE enforcers. But if we get a lawful order, we're going to obey it. And I was talking to our police chief about a month or so ago, and he was furious because we had a guy that we needed, was in the DeKalb County Jail. He was Hispanic. We sent a request to hold him because we needed him, and they turned him loose. I mean, it's not just ICE. It's even within local jurisdictions, and that's a problem. You got some bad actors out there, and we really should deal with them. And law enforcement should cooperate at a reasonable level to be able, and if another agency, I mean, if we get a lawful order, we're going to obey it. I mean, that's it.
Let me ask the lawyer among us. Where does posse comitatus come into here?
I don't know. A posse comitatus is a little different. That's when really the military goes out to do public law enforcement. But this is to me, certainly, and I have the privilege of being a public safety director in addition to mayor. And so we deal with this a lot. But I will tell you, we have a very cooperative relationship with ICE. And I'm very concerned of what citizens think. I think they're being stoked for some sort of political, electoral advantage about something and misinformed. So the way it works in almost every jurisdiction, and sure, there's always a rogue or incompetent jurisdiction out there for whatever reason, but your local law enforcement is solving murders, crimes, and keeping the streets safe. But they work with FBI, ATF, ICE, all sorts of other jurisdictions. And so when someone comes in, let's say someone comes in with a DUI, is put in jail, that person is fingerprinted, goes into a system. If ICE reports back, hey, we're looking for that guy, an automatic 24-hour detainer goes on, as it would if the FBI said, hey, I think he's somebody we want to talk to and something we're investigating. That happens. That is happening all over
the state. So it's a cooperative arrangement that makes sense to you.
Exactly. And we hold them, and then they come get them if they want them, or no, that's not the guy, go ahead and turn them loose. If they don't say anything or don't say anything timely, we don't know. We turn the guy loose. We don't have access to that information. But I will say this business about somehow suggesting that local law enforcement is not doing their job is just erroneous, and right. citizens shouldn't believe
I agree
it.
With that. I agree 100%. That we do the exact same thing.
Okay, bonus question, because we're virtually out of time. Karen McDougal went on CNN last night and told Anderson Cooper that, yes, she'd had an adulterous affair with Donald Trump. Sunday, Stormy Daniels will be on 60 Minutes, where she will say, apparently, yes, I had an adulterous affair with Donald Trump. Your bonus question, and it's almost a yes or no question, is, will this have any impact whatsoever on the people who still loved President Trump, or is it meaningless?
Evangelicals will still stick with them.
I agree.
It's irrelevant from as far as impact on the presidency, but there is this drip, 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 drip thing that you always have to worry about in politics, and that's the you use the word tipping point. There may be a tipping point out there where some of this stuff begins to weigh in. We'll see.
Yeah, I said a moment ago, I agree. I agreed with Jim's statement that that for the evangelicals, they will never be deterred from their allegiance to Donald Trump. I don't really know why, but that is the case. And I think everybody knew he was a cad, and so that's not surprising. I will say that it is creating a theme of the cover-ups, and the money is something that he starts getting into pretty dicey waters. And so that's a whole nother chapter.
These non-disclosure agreements
exactly.
that he's required White House aides to sign.
Yes.
That could be very dangerous.
Yes, and it plays into the theme that's being suggested about asking people to cover up other investigations and so forth.
All right, I got to call a halt to it. We are out of time for today's show. Thank you. This is really a good conversation. Teresa Tomlinson, we always love it when you make the drive up from Columbus to be in the studio. And Rusty Paul, your drive, sometimes your drive probably is as long as Teresa's coming from Sandy Springs. You know how much we like having you with us, too. Jim Galloway, I hope you're going to have a terrific weekend, and I look forward to seeing you here again on Monday. We'll probably talk a little bit more about Zell Miller, because there's so many things didn't get to. And by then, we'll know all the details of the services for him. So in the meantime, all of you out there, if you're listening in real time, have a terrific weekend. We'll be back at 2 o'clock on Monday with another Political Rewind.